Today's episode of Hack the Entrepreneur is supported by Google. An ad on Google can help your business find new customers at the exact moment they are searching for what you have to offer. Go to g.co/hackpodcast and you will get a $75 credit after the first $25 you invest. That's g.co/hackpodcast.
Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me today. I am your host, John Naster, but you can call me Johnny. My guest today is an author, creator, and an entrepreneur. He has a great personal motto. Life's too short to build something nobody wants. He's been building web-based products for more than a decade. He started building his own products as the founder of Wired Reach with their flagship product, BoxCloud. He is currently the founder and CEO of Lean Stack, where they built tools, content, and coaching that help entrepreneurs succeed. He's also the author of Running Lean and the brand new book, Scaling Lean. Now, let's hack Ash Maria. I want to thank today's sponsor, Braintree. Think back if you can. Remember that very first dollar you made in business. Now, you want to grow to your millionth or possibly your billionth. But have you found the right payments partner to grow with you and your business? Braintree lets you accept every way to pay, from PayPal to Apple Pay and everything in between. All it takes is one integration. And it doesn't matter what currency your customers use because Braintree lets you accept over 130 of them. To learn more about how you and your company can grow with Braintree, simply visit braintreepayments.com/hack. That's braintreepayments.com/hack. And learn how Braintree will allow you and your business to grow. We are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. Today we have a very, very special guest. Ash, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, John. It's a pleasure.
Oh, pleasure is all mine, and I think this is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, let's jump into it. Ash, as an entrepreneur, can you tell me what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
The one thing. So it is literally one thing. So I wake up every day and try to figure out the one thing I need to get done before anything else. And I've done this like clockwork for as long as I can remember. And where that really comes from. So I had a mentor a few years ago that told me this concept of right action, right time. He told me I could spend my time doing, you know, hundreds of things daily, but there are usually a few things that ultimately matter. And figuring those out, and you hear this in different ways, Pareto's law and the single domino type of a thing. But for me, just that mantra, that routine of getting up and trying to understand where things stand and what is the one thing, because I'm very accomplishment driven, that I can get done usually before the meeting start, before the interruption start. That's what I've done for forever.
Wow. So how, obviously, right action, right time, it sounds perfectly logical and clear, but how do you find that? Can you tell us sort of how you discover or determine what that right action is and when you do it actually?
Yeah. So it does seem very simple and philosophical. At the same time, it kind of breaks it. I think it starts off with having just a few very high level but concrete goals. And so it's misleading to say I only do one thing at a time because people at least look at what I do with the company. You know, I write books, I build software. And so it's impossible that I'm doing one thing at any given time. But the way I answer that is that if you look at a juggler, especially when they're doing three ball juggling, they give you the illusion that they have three balls in the air, but there's only really one ball in the air. The other two are kind of lying there motionless in their hands. And so it's that same thing. So when I think of a project, I try to, if let's just say I have to give a keynote in 6 months, I wouldn't just think of that one thing. I'll think of what are all the other things I can do to prepare myself? So I may do a more casual speaking event, or I may go and write a small blog post on the topic, or I may go and do build something that could potentially go into the product. And so the idea is that I find a lot of small additive things that still all add up towards that one goal. So when I say the one thing, it's really one goal. And so every year I start out with one or two big goals for the year. And all the other days that I spend kind of throughout the year are small little experiments, if I use the lean term, to get myself towards hitting that goal.
Nice. You're just breaking the big ideas into, or the overarching concepts into, smaller daily parts.
Yeah. And there's an art to fitting that in. So the other thing I'm a big fan of is time boxing. So actually, these are some of the ideas that are, you know, write about quite a bit. But you can take any strategy. Let's say you want to explore something like content marketing. Maybe I should do a podcast. You know, I could go and invest a lot in understanding what goes into doing a podcast. But why don't I just get on some shows? And that could be the one thing that I do. So that's how I learn more about it. And then I could just record one show and make a commitment to do one and measure that in some way. So I don't have to spend 6 months of planning. I can do this in potentially a few days and maybe at most a 2 week window, convince myself whether that makes sense for me and my business and my goals. And if it does, I double down on it. If not, we go find something else.
Nice. You should start a podcast. And is this something that you use to also kind of keep yourself from stalling?
Absolutely, yes. So there's elements in this process of, you know, both time boxing, but then holding yourself externally accountable. And so this might be to your team, this might be to an advisor, it might be to your spouse, but you kind of declare that goal, which is, I'd like to achieve this thing by this time frame. And then you kind of build a partnership with them where you can give them these frequent updates. And you want to make it an environment where people can call your BS. So over the years, I built some close friends who are other entrepreneurs, but they're good at what they do. But it's very clear. We meet up, you know, every now and then, and we just give updates on what's working, what's not working, and they can totally call your BS. And I love that kind of honesty, because you get into a lot of situations where people avoid confrontation and they just string you along. And that's the worst kind of advice or advisor you can have on your side.
Yeah. Excellent. So let's go back if we can, Ash. There seems to be, looking back in entrepreneurs' lives, there seems to be this time, this certain place where they've realized one of two things, that either you had this calling to make this huge difference in the world, or you found that you simply just could not work for somebody else anymore. Ash, can you tell me what side of the fence you see yourself on, and then sort of take us back to when that happened for you?
Yeah, so I think I did have one of those forks in the road, but it was not about entrepreneurship. So I always had the entrepreneurial spirit, or you can say the Kool-Aid. I always wanted to build my own company. And, you know, throughout my college years, I went to school for engineering. I read lots of business books. I came to the US on a student visa, so I couldn't go out and start a company, but I did the next best thing, which is work for startups, which in retrospect was a blessing, because I got to learn kind of on their dime. I got to see them make the mistakes. And then I had to make some of my own. But the point of all of that is that I didn't really have a problem working for other people. And that was not so much what caused me to switch directions. When I did start my own company, like everyone else, I made my mistakes. What really bothered me is that was not so much the success and failure rate. So I built products, some were successful, some weren't. What really bothered me was that I didn't have a repeatable process for predicting whether an idea was any good or not for at least a year and a half to 2 years. And so I would do all the same things. I would go and build this thing out. I would launch it. And then I would realize this was a big mistake. And so I would kill it. And other ones would be successful. So I became more interested in kind of what can one do in the very early stages of an idea. And to me, that was something that, again, was not like a overnight change. But I began researching this. I got sucked into some of the lean startup body of work that Eric Ries was putting out, Steve Blank was putting out. And I joined in the conversation. And at some point, I began to realize that there were a lot of these patterns. What we see in there really apply to a lot of people. And that, to me, you can say was a bit of that awakening moment where I realized that what I do well is maybe take some of these ideas and make them more practicable. And I started speaking more. I started doing workshops. And this was, I was a closeted technical geek, so I never did any of the speaking circuit types of things before. But I found that one thing that I was comfortable doing and found that the message was resonating and people had the same problems that I was describing. And that's what got me started in all of this.
Nice. And so I'm assuming you couldn't start a business. So you did the next best thing, which was worked for startups. Now you've founded your own companies. Is there a part of you, or is it off the table completely, that you would ever go back and work for another startup at this point?
It's becoming harder, but I think if I can find the right team, so we get picky over the years. So having run a business, I definitely, like the control, I like the autonomy. And so I wouldn't have a problem if we share the same culture of how I work. So my company, the way we structure internally is also very autonomous. We don't really have a command and control type of a structure, and I can get into that if you want. But if I found something that was that had that same kind of an environment, I wouldn't have an issue working with the team that would allow me to do that.
Nice. Yeah, and fair enough. It's true. The further we get into it, the harder it is to go back. But what is this autonomous structure you have in your company?
Yeah, so one of the key messages that I try to put out there, and this was, if I summarize all of my learning over the years, it was a realization that we all are specialists to some extent. So we all go to school and we learn how to do engineering or design or marketing, sales, whatever it is. And then we try to fit every problem with that kind of a myopic view. So if I gave you a problem, say we've got a conversion rate problem on a landing page, my designers will want to improve the usability. My developers may want to build more features. My marketers may want to do more advertising. So I call that the curse of specialization. And I've seen that everywhere I've gone. We see this in large companies, but even in the startup environment, when I say, here's the problem, we just have all kinds of solutions that are very, very, very biased. And so again, you have to look at it as both a curse and a blessing. The reason we are specialized is that we do bring our skills and talents and strengths. And so you want that, but you still have to test all of that. So the environment we build is that we make it very simple for anyone to have an idea. But when they have an idea, along with it comes that two-week experiment that I described early on. So they need to describe what they want to do, what might be the potential upside of this idea, and then how are they going to quickly test that. And on the merits of that, we decide, let's run the experiment. And we have got enough slack in the team to kind of work on many ideas at once. And so we'll do that. And then if the idea was any good, we'll double down on it. And if not, no harm done, we'll just go and take the next idea in our backlog of ideas. So it's that same kind of what I opened up with, is that as a team, we also have goals in the business and we break that into these smaller chunks. And the thing that I truly believe is that no one in the company knows the answer. And so the person who presents a potential solution, ideally, we try to create a culture where they are simultaneously the biggest skeptic of it. And I know it sounds, very scientific. That's what scientists do very well, is they come up with a theory, but they look for invalidation, not validation, because we can never prove anything completely true, but we can prove that it was not true and then refine the theory from there.
Yeah, it's interesting. And so with everybody sort of having that autonomy and then having to disprove themselves, and having these overarching goals for the company itself, who then determines those overarching goals?
Yes. So that's where we have a, we take this term from the software world, sprints. So we run these sprints, and the role of the leader, and oftentimes that's me if I'm the leader of that particular product, is to describe the current state. So we would describe the state. And we're very careful about talking about what we see currently wrong, like what are some of the obstacles holding us back without getting into the solution, because that's the danger that many people run into, is the moment someone starts describing a solution, it's just a rabbit hole where there's groupthink that begins to set in. If you've got hippos in the room, so hippos is a term coined at Amazon for highest paid official. If you've got somebody like a CEO or an executive in the room and they start talking about a potential solution, everyone seems to gravitate towards it because they must know what they're talking about. And so we try to avoid any solution conversation. So the job of the person leading that initial problem exploration is to describe the problem. We might use metrics. We might use some of the business modeling tools that we build and say, here's where all the problems lie. You guys need to go away now and think of some solutions. And then we disperse. So we go away and we don't do this as a group activity. Everyone goes off because they're allowed to independently think. We then convene back again, and then people present their ideas. We've even tried this anonymously. We've had people just do a one pager on the idea. And then if people want to learn more, the idea generator, the idea owner is revealed, and then they go on and do the full kind of walkthrough of the idea. So we find that kind of takes it, brings more of a meritocratic approach to how companies decide what's important or not. So the metrics can be, you know, can't lie. And so we make that very transparent. Everyone can see what's happening. We together agree where the problems are, you know, where the leaky buckets are, where the bottlenecks are. We don't know how to fix them, but that's where we allow people to go away. And then we come back and run tests to see if any of those ideas can break through that bottleneck.
It sounds really smart, yet slightly idealistic, maybe.
Sure.
Like what's a common struggle that you have by keeping it so like autocratic?
I think it's maybe the biggest pitfall is actually doing it on a regular basis. So I mentioned time boxing in the beginning. So as humans, we are just filled up with all kinds of cognitive biases. You know, even though I say, you know, when you describe the idealistic, that's where what I'm reading into is that people love their idea over other ideas. And so it sounds too utopian. But the other thing that I often see is that when people start collecting data or collecting evidence for their idea, they use a lot of selection bias. They wait for data to be good before they are ready to report on them and all that kind of stuff. And so the way that we try to avoid some of those types of things is when we run these sprints, we have a very clear time box. So we may run an experiment for 2 weeks. And when that 2 weeks comes, we're not waiting for better data to come in. We're just taking whatever we have and we're going to get together in a room and again, talk about whether that was any good or not. And so it is hard at the beginning because you're going to have people's emotions, you know, be egos and emotions kind of get into the way. But what I found, and that was, again, going back to my story of that transformation, the thing that I hit after a while is that I used to always be the one or want to be the one that was always right in the room. So I would defend my ideas and argue and debate. And then I began to realize that it was more important to actually build the right thing or do the right thing, build the right product in this case, than always be right or appear to be right. And that's it's a leadership trait. So when I work with my teams, I can see all the biases, I can see everything, and we try to make it very, what's the word? We try to make a game out of it. So when we talk about what this idea can potentially do as an upside, and if we do this campaign, are we looking at a 10% lift or a 20% lift? Rather than putting people on the spot, we allow everyone to take a guess, and we just call it that. It's just our best guess. And we make it very light, and I award a small token prize. What's very interesting, though, is that when we make kind of light of it, people are more willing to take bold bets, and they're more willing to try things that could be very risky because we create that safe environment. And some of those have actually led to some amazing things. Many of them haven't, but the ones that don't, they actually allow that individual to now have better judgment. So they may have been very bullish in the beginning and, you know, completely fell flat on their face. But because they now know that they were overreaching, the next time around, they actually adjust their estimates down a bit. And we find that happening across the board. So when we get new people, we just have this culture of making it kind of very light. But as we run through this over time, we begin to see that we're actually coming up with more, you know, I would say better ideas. I wouldn't say good ideas, but better ideas than when we started.
Yeah, I like it. And it's really, it truly is trying to stay with that scientific approach.
Yeah.
And not try and prove yourself right all the time. But I think you're right. Just because there's humans involved, that's all that makes up the company, right? Is going to be human beings.
Right.
And oftentimes egos and feelings get in the way of that sometimes.
Yeah. And that's why, so I am a big fan of small teams. Even when I do some work with larger companies, one of the recommendations is to split a 30-person team into maybe 6 5-person teams. And that's when you can build this kind of honesty in that size. When you add more people, you know, that's when all these complexities come in and all these power plays and biases begin to fit in or come in. And so I do find that there are some elements for making this work. We are a small team. We are less than 5 people at the moment. And so we can do these kinds of things and really have built a good working relationship with everyone that has not been an issue.
Excellent. Okay, so your one thing you told us at the beginning is defining that one thing. The right action at the right time through time boxing. And you're obviously a really, really, truly good leader as well with your team. So every expert now, and you mentioned Pareto's Law, so every expert talks about the 80-20, right? So within your business, you should do 20% of the work that gets 80% of the results.
Right.
Do what you're good at and delegate the rest. Ash, I would love if you could tell me something that you are absolutely not good at in your business.
Absolutely not calendar scheduling. So setting up meetings, appointments, just agreeing on a time when we could we could meet and talk. I'm just terrible at that. And so part of the reason is I talk to people, you know, in different parts of the world. And so the time zones always get me, the daylight, are we in daylight savings or not? Are they in daylight savings or not? So I know there are tools out there, but I always mess that up. And so I fixed that after too many missed meetings. I first, you know, invested in some software tools, but that worked when everything worked well. But the moment there was an exception, if someone said, oh, I can't make this one, that's again where we'll reschedule and then we'll just mess it all up. So now I have a virtual assistant. I use a service, and that has been, you know, for me, kind of the way out. I just don't even try to make the appointments anymore.
Are you going to share with us the service you use?
So I was using Zirtual, and now I'm using Red Butler. So switched to them after Zirtual kind of went away, and then they came back. But I just moved to Red Butler, and that's what I use.
Excellent. Okay, so let's move, if we can, to projects. Well, I'm wondering if I can actually take you maybe off guard a little bit, but usually this is where I want to get to projects and what a new project is somebody would undertake, what you would to start, say, a new project, but even go so far as to start a new business idea, to know that it's right for you and that you should sort of put your time, energy, and resources into it.
Yeah.
But the natural process that people want to do so often with that is to create a business plan. And I know you have very strong opinions on a business plan. So if someone comes up with an idea and wants to run with it, could we maybe walk through what a correct path for somebody to take their idea and sort of act on it would be?
Sure. So one, I'll be very clear that I'm not so much against business planning. So I make a distinction there. So I think business planning is absolutely critical. So you do have to have some of those goals in mind. If you just have the just do it attitude or the no plan kind of approach, that's where all those biases will come in. So I sometimes joke that entrepreneurs are especially gifted at post-rationalization. So you could launch a product and it doesn't sell. It's because you launched it at the wrong time of the year. Maybe it was summer, maybe it was Christmas. You know, there are all kinds of things could be happening. So we can always post-rationalize that, you know, bad things happen, but it's okay. So it's important to draw that line in the sand. Now, the issue I have with the business plan is not so much, again, in the process, because I think it's a great exercise for the entrepreneur. The problem is that nobody reads that document at the end of the day. So you spend all this time writing up all these pages, you put all these forecasts in there and pretty charts, and then nobody takes the time to read it because it's such a long document. They'll rather have you come in and give them the 10-page slide deck version or the one-page executive summary or the 30-second elevator pitch. And so if you're going to have to condense it down, that's one part of the story. The other part is that the business plan I've not seen a business plan to date that has stayed intact. So the moment you write it and get outside the building and start doing the building of the business, the plan changes entirely. And so no one goes back and updates that. So for all those reasons, I'm against the business plan as a format, but not against business planning. So the thing that I do advocate is doing some amount of work. And so this is where the original business model canvas, I created a riff on that called the Lean Canvas, is where I point people. The Lean Canvas are 9 building blocks that are typically 9 chapters that go into a business plan. They talk about who is your customer, what problem are you solving, how are you going to solve it, what channels do you use, how do you make money. So there are these boxes, but rather than writing a document, you write a one pager. So it's all one page and you put it all on there. And to me, that's the first exercise, is take your idea and deconstruct it into those 9 building blocks. And I often joke and say it's a lot like putting Lego pieces together, is that you may have some pieces that seem to fit, but the others don't. And so you can kind of play with that. And once you've got a coherent business model story, that's when you've got maybe more than just the inclination of, let me go build this and see what happens. You can now kind of see how the pieces fit together. So that to me is usually step one. And then step two is getting outside the building and tackling what's riskiest, not what's easiest on the plan, but what's riskiest, and start there. So this is essentially product development 101 applied to business modeling as a product. And what I mean by that is that if you had 6 months to build something really complex, you wouldn't start with the easy stuff. You would start with the riskier stuff so that by month 5, you're not thrashing like crazy. And so that's the same kind of common sense, you know, attitude that we try to instill into entrepreneurs, is let's look at your idea. Let's break it into the whole business model, because that's the true product. Let's figure out what's riskiest and tackle that only, and tackle that first. And that's the right action, right time concept applied there. Once you can tackle that riskiest thing, let's move on to the next riskiest and then kind of walk the canvas that way. So to me, that's usually the process that I advocate for starting anything.
Yeah, and that's, I think, probably to really get your head and sort of synthesize the idea better. I mean, in a 40-page document, you can kind of muddle your way through almost. Like, when you have to turn it into one page,
yeah,
you really have to know your ideas.
Absolutely, yes.
And so what is, you just quickly went past, but you said that your business model is your...
So this was, again, being a tech guy, I always thought solution was what mattered or the product mattered. And if you build a great X, you know, magic things happen, customers come find you. And I realized that you can build the best product in the world, but if you have no way of getting it out, if you don't have a channel or a path to customers, it's going to fail still. It's going to just die a slow and silent death and eventually will die. So for me, like a big transformation or big epiphany that happened in part of that journey that I was describing early on was this realization that building a great solution is very important, but every entrepreneur needs to look at the entire business model as their true product. And their job is one of de-risking that business model over time. So if I came with you with an idea and I wanted you to join my team, you're going to be like, I have a great paying job. Why should I come join you? So my job as a founder is to de-risk it enough to where you can see that this will be worth your time. When I go to an investor, I do the same thing. So I ask for money, which is, again, not charity. I have to give a return on that investment. So I need to de-risk it sufficiently to where they can make that transaction with me. When we similarly go to customers, we do the exact same thing. I describe my idea, maybe not, you know, all the internals, but I describe what the customers care about. And then I have to de-risk it in terms of existing alternatives, because they're probably using my competitors' products or doing other things right now. I need to tell them why mine will be better than whatever it is that they're doing. So I'm de-risking again. So that's kind of where that comes from. And so when you look at the business model as what we're really building and not just being limited to the solution box, which is one of the boxes on the canvas, but looking at it more holistically, the risks can come from anywhere and we have to tackle them from high risk to low risk.
I love it. And it's really the idea of you have to, I mean, to go back to what you even said, that curse of specialization, that if we're sort of focusing on ourselves too much and not thinking that, okay, now we're talking to a customer, now we're talking to an investor, now we're talking to a potential employee,
right?
You kind of have to change the story or what it,
yep,
like sort of the messaging behind it, right? So that you can de-risk it for that person in their context, not yours.
In their language, yes. And I often cite, so Seth Godin wrote a great book, All Marketers Are Liars, and then he crossed that out and said, tell stories. And I kind of have a riff on that. I did a blog post where all entrepreneurs tell stories. And again, the story you tell, we all try to, if you see an entrepreneur pitching, they have memorized this one pitch that they tell everyone. I sometimes get approached and people are pitching me like I'm going to invest in their business, and I'm not. I'm not ready to be an investor in that conversation. And so it's exactly what you said. You have to understand who the other person is you're talking to. And then the canvas gives you all the kind of assets that you need to weave that story. But the story that you tell is going to be so dependent on who the other person is you're speaking with.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm going to link to the canvas is available to use, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so I have used it before and I will use it again. And I will link to it in the show notes, which we'll go over shortly. But I just, in case anybody's listening and wondering where they can find this thing we just talked about, we will tell you shortly. But Ash, before we're finished this really excellent conversation, I want to wrap up on one final question for you. It's this idea I'm calling the entrepreneurial gap. So as entrepreneurs, as dreamers, we have things that we're always sort of projecting our successes into the future, right? You have a book coming out very shortly. And so when that book comes out, you might see yourself as a quote unquote success, but probably right as that's about to happen, you're going to think about the next book. Or when you stand on that stage in 6 months, or when you hit that revenue metric in 8 months, you'll be successful. Yet we all know before we hit all of these goals, we set bigger, loftier ones into the future, and we continually focus on our one thing to get further and further.
Right.
From the outside, often we look very, very successful, and to ourselves, we're never quite there. So we live in this gap that no matter what we accomplish, we're just never successful. It's like walking towards the horizon. Obviously, the further you walk, the further away it always gets.
Mm-hmm.
So Ash, right now, I would love it if you could stop and turn and look behind you. Your whole sort of entrepreneurial journey up till now, the highs, the lows, the wins, the losses, but tell me how you feel about all of it up until this very moment.
I feel like I'm in a good place. So I sometimes describe what you just said as three stages in the entrepreneurial journey. And I look at the first one as what I call the artist stage. So like artists, we all want to do great art. We want to be appreciated. You know, we want to be recognized. We want fame, fortune. And then I describe the second stage. So, you know, creating art, as we know, is not enough because artists have to eat too. The second stage is when the entrepreneurs get that business savvy. And again, the business folks may already have that, but I find a lot of the techie entrepreneurs I work with, you know, have that moment where they realize that making money is a skill and they have to learn how to do it. Otherwise, this business is not going to work. So that to me is the artist must eat stage as well, or, you know, otherwise they'll starve. So that's where we get that business savvy. And then at some point, people get good at that as well. And then they realize that there's more to life. And then there's the purpose stage. And that to me is the third stage. And, you know, maybe there's something beyond that, but that's all I know. And so when people find that purpose, whether it's, you know, having impact or trying to change something or doing something, it typically is not driven by money. So the question, the way I answer your question is, I tell people, what would you want to accomplish other than making money? And if you can describe that and get there, then I find that you reach that fulfilled point. And so in my journeys, I've gone through all of those stages. I built things that I thought were awesome. Not a lot of people thought they were, some did. I then went and learned how to make businesses out of them. And then I sold those businesses and I realized that what I'm really doing now is the thing that I like. So I found a customer. To me, it's working with entrepreneurs. I found a problem, which is in some ways, some of the problems we deal with that we're talking about here today. And I found that I can commit the rest of my life just looking for solutions. It's a big enough problem and it has a lot of potential impact. And so I'm kind of very happy being in that place right now.
I love it. I love it. Beautiful answer, Ash. So we've got to talk about your business in passing and you have a brand new book out. Could you tell the listener right now about your brand new book, where they can find it, and then where they can also track you down online?
Sure. So I've written two books. The first book is Running Lean. That's readily available on Amazon. The second book, which is a standalone book, but definitely, you know, sorts of sequels. It's kind of a grown up version of Running Lean. So Running Lean is about what you do when you're starting with a new idea. Scaling Lean is more, as you can imagine, kind of what comes next. That book is going to be available in June, and it will be available everywhere. So you can find that also on Amazon. We do have a URL, scalinglean.com. That you can kind of more easy to remember and check that out. And then I can be found on leanstack.com. That's where you'll find a lot of my contact information, my writings, and other stuff all out there.
Excellent. LeanStack is also where you can find the Lean Canvas, right? And use it for free.
Yeah, that's right.
Excellent. So leanstack.com. Scaling Lean is the brand new book. I'll link to that in the show notes, as well as I'm going to find a link for Red Butler. And there's an excellent article, Ash, that you wrote on LinkedIn called It's Time to Fire the Business Plan for Good,
sure,
where you go into detail about what we talked about today. And so I'll link to that as well for everyone of you out there listening. You can find that on Hack the Entrepreneur when you get a chance. So Ash, once again, thank you so much for taking the time to join me. Please just keep doing what you're doing because it is awesome and inspiring to watch.
Thank you very much, John.
Ash, thank you so much for joining me. That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope you out there listening enjoyed that as much as I did. Ash is a smart entrepreneur who's doing a lot of cool things, and I mean, I gotta say, I love that life's too short to build something nobody wants. it makes me happy to hear. So I got to now go through the conversation. Right, we've reached the part in the show where we have to go back. We have to see if we can find something that Ash said. So I went back and I listened. There was 9 things that I had marked down during the conversation that I need to go back and listen to. So I went back and I listened. And then I listened again, then I listened again, and then I listened again. That last time that I went through the conversation, it was right there. It was so just very clear to me, that one thing that Ash said. Did you get it? Did you hear it? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
We all are specialists to some extent. So we all go to school and we learn how to do engineering or design or marketing, sales, whatever it is. And then we try to fit every problem with that kind of a myopic view. So if I gave you a problem, say we've got a conversion rate problem on a landing page, my designers will want to improve the usability. My developers may want to build more features. My marketers may want to do more advertising. So I call that the curse of specialization.
And that's the hack. Ash, ash, ash. The curse of specialization. I like this a lot. This is really interesting because that view, like you say, we all are educated in some way, whether it's through school or through experience, whatever that happens to be, and we all have our skill sets. And we all need to know that we have some part of us holds the curse of specialization. And we're going to see it, as Ash says, through this myopic view of this very narrow view of from our perspective, not from our customer's perspective, not from our potential customer's perspective, or not even just from a user perspective, depending on what your product or service is. And this is really, really crucial. So whether you're an engineer, a designer, a marketer, a salesperson, like Ash says, you're going to have this curse. And so you, as the entrepreneur, you're also going to have this curse. But I think that it's also essential that we understand this curse, not only in ourselves, but in people we hire, in contractors we hire, in developers, in designers. Because it's true, when you're working with a developer to get a product, I'm completely non-technical. So when I need something developed, I have to hire a developer. And this is something I didn't even know really how to pin it down. But I remember years ago hiring my first developer and trying to get something built. And the way the developer thought about it was completely 100% from a developer perspective, not from a user perspective. And so these are the things that you need to be aware of, this curse of specialization. As I said, within yourself, but also almost more importantly as the entrepreneur, within people that are on your team, within people that are going to build products and services with and for you. Because we always have to be able to step outside of it, avoid that curse, and create things for our customer. Build products for our customer. Remember, it's not about us. It's always about them. This curse of specialization gets in that way. Be aware of it. If you need to, just come back to Ash and remember, we have to. We all fall prey to the curse of specialization. And we are all specialists in some way, and that's why this happens. Be aware and avoid it in yourself as much as possible and in everyone around you. Ash, thank you very much. All right, that was fun. So I have created something cool, Hack the Entrepreneur Top 10. 225 episodes into the show, I decided to create a place for you to hear the 10 best episodes I've ever put out. Yeah, hte.io/10 will take you right there, or just go to hacktheentrepreneur.com and you'll see it on the sidebar or in the navigation menu. There's a page with all the episodes there. And you can also subscribe straight in iTunes if you just want to download all the episodes right now and check them out. I think it's a really cool, it's a cool starting point. I want to give you sort of a start here and sort of get an idea of what Hack the Entrepreneur. I think it sets up a great foundation for what I'm trying to create with the show for you. So yeah, check it out, hacktheentrepreneur.com. You'll see the top 10. All right, it's been an absolute blast. I thank you so much for joining me again today. I know you have a lot of options, and I'm so happy you took the time with me. So, thank you again, and please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.